Welcome to the 67th A.W. Mellon Lectures in the Fine Arts. In this six-part lecture series, entitled Positive Barbarism, Brutal Aesthetics in the Post-War Period, art historian Hal Foster explores the pervasive turn from the mid-1940s to the early 1960s to the bru and the brutalist, the animal and the creaturely, as these are manifest in the early work of Jean Dubuffet, Georges Bataille, Asger Jorn, Eduardo Paolozzi, and Klaus Oldenburg. In this fourth lecture, entitled Asger Jorn and His Creatures, delivered at the National Gallery of Art on April 29, 2018, Foster considers how Jorn saw the beastly figures of his cobra paintings as expressions of political crisis.
Here's our artist for today, Asger Jorn, in 1962, at the age of 58, in my favorite photograph of the charismatic Dane. Taken for the cover of his book, Value and Economy, it shows him in the guise of Marx, and the homage cum travesti is characteristic of this playful artist. The caption reads, Asger Jorn as an adult man, as though he had to stretch to perform the role. At the time, Jorn had just left the Situationist International, which he founded with Guy Debord in 1957, mostly because his radical French friend had called for all artistic activity to be put aside in favor of direct political action against the society of the spectacle. Jorn continued to support the activities of the group nonetheless, ironically through the sale of his art. The Situationist Jorn is relatively familiar today. I want to focus instead on the Jorn of the Cobra movement in the immediate post-war years, the one with affinities with the figures I have discussed so far, Dubuffet and Bataille. Here he is with Dubuffet. And here is a postcard that Jorn sent to, that Debord sent to Jorn from Lascaux, with the Chinese horse there assigned to Jorn. In the late 1940s, young artists in Copenhagen, Brussels, and Amsterdam insisted on the necessity of a new approach to the brutal aftermath of the war. They did so under the name COBRA, an acronym of the cities where they were based, as well as a tribute to the snake they adopted as a totem. Already during the war, a group of painters and sculptors in Copenhagen had formed around the magazine Hellhesten, or Hell Horse, which was edited by the precocious Jorn. He was 27 in 1941. Encouraged by this example, three upstarts in Amsterdam, Constant Nieuwenhuis, Carol Appel, and Corneille, launched the experimental group in Holland with a magazine of their own called Reflex. Finally, in Brussels, where surrealism lingered as a force, young writers directed the scene, especially Christian Dautremont, who would soon edit the eponymous magazine of Cobra. Jorn met Constant in the fall of 1946 and contacted Dautremont the next summer. By late 1948, the three were able to forge a coalition, one that, as fragile as it was intense, lasted little more than 3 years. Despite ample evidence of the Stalin purges, the three refused to abandon communism, and they insisted on dialectical materialism as essential to artistic experiment. They were linked, too, in their opposition to both formalist and functionalist positions in modernist art and architecture. Jorn reacted against his early training under Fernand Léger in association with Le Corbusier in Paris, and Constant turned against his Dutch forebears in De Stael. At the same time, Jorn and Constant wanted to depart from surrealism, aspects of which, a painterly automatism above all, they adapted nonetheless. By means of this irrational spontaneity, Jorn wrote in the first issue of Cobra, with this automatist technique in mind, we get closer to the vital source of life. Does the aim of the vital source of life make Cobra a belated expressionism, one inflected by primitivism and surrealism? Or is there a distinctive program to be extracted from its different practices, a Cobra idea? Its concern with the arts of tribal people, children, and the insane is familiar from pre-war avant-gardes. And the Cobra involvement with folk culture, Jorn in particular, was fascinated by Nordic myths, Viking monuments, medieval frescoes, rural churches, and so on. This does not specify the group adequately either. However, one attribute does distinguish Cobra, at least I think, its special penchant for the animal, or better, the creaturely. And that is my thesis for today. Consider The Cry of Freedom by Carol Appel. As often with de Buffet, the painting presents a figure full in the canvas, barely contained by the cage of the frame. This one is made of a patchwork of hot reds, yellows, and oranges, relieved only by swatches of cool blues, greens, and blacks. The schematic head, its simple features blocked out in black, confronts us as if in terror. The asymmetrical wings are deformed and useless. Though the pink of flesh, they resemble stubby claws, and they fail to protect the tiny body, which is propped up on three spindly legs. Neither human, nor animal, nor bird, it is all three, a newfangled beast whose cry of freedom seems to announce a damaged past as much as a transformed future. It is as though the Angelus Novus of Paul Klee, made soon after World War I, read as an apocalyptic figure by Walter Benjamin, were reborn not long after World War II as a mutant phoenix. Or consider Erotic Moment by Constant, a watercolor produced in the same year as his polemic It's Our Desire That Makes the Revolution, which is published in the fourth issue of Cobra. A lewd picture dominated by fecal browns, it appears to show two figures commingled sexually in a Bataillon eroticism that transforms discrete bodies into charged parts that are ecstatically exchanged. A wild-eyed creature raises its arms exultantly, one arm begins as an obscene nose, the other ends in a paw of three digits. Meanwhile, its partner, head thrown back, sticks a penile tongue into its mouth, even though this figure is marked as female by the large vulva located at center in the long wave of hair down its back. Gender ambiguity is a staple in Duchamp, Giacometti, and others, yet the force of this confusion is different here. Not a frustrated search for the lost object of sexual desire, a la surrealism, but an unbridled expression of revolutionary passion, a la Cobra. How are we to understand such figures, which are altogether typical of Cobra art? Our first clue can be found in a 1948 manifesto by Constant, who frames the post-war condition in dialectical terms, as a total collapse that might yet permit a new freedom. As long as artists find their way back to the first point of origin of creative activity. In his own search for a zero degree of art, Constant, like de Buffet, champions expressions from the untaught. Again, the modernist trio of primitive, child, and insane. But then, like Bataille, he refers enigmatically to post-war man as a creature and delivers this striking definition. A painting is not a construction of colors and lines, but an animal, a knight, a scream, a human being, or all of these. Here, Constant overturns the formalist formula of modernist painting presented 60 years before by Maurice Denis, Remember that a painting, before it is a battle horse, a nude model, or some anecdote, is a flat surface covered with colors assembled in a certain order. And he also, Constant also intimates that the creaturely is a cipher of the confused aftermath of the war, of a broken down condition in which limitations are dissolved. In effect, a state of emergency as much as a condition of freedom. Jorn rises to the challenge. We must portray ourselves as human beasts, he writes Constant in a letter of 1950. Jorn identifies with the creaturely as fully as Bataille does with the animal. If we pull back for a moment, we can see Cobra as an artistic intervention in the post-war debate about humanism, one that engaged the preeminent thinkers of the time, above all Sartre, who insisted that his existentialism was a humanism, and Heidegger, who dismissed both concepts as metaphysical. For far too long, Heidegger argued, Western philosophy had defined the human in its difference from the animal. Man possesses language and reason, the animal does not, and so on. And this anthropological machine had subjected the natural world to instrumental abuse. At the same time, Heidegger refused any celebration of the animal as a counterterm to the human. Famously, he declared that whereas the stone is worldless and the animal is poor in world, man alone is world-making. And elsewhere, he charged Rilke in his eighth Duino elegy with the gross misunderstanding that animals are closer to being, to Dasein, than man is. Had Heidegger known Cobra, he would have condemned it on the same grounds. For it too valued the animal as more immediate than the human to the vital source of life. Not only do the untamed expression in the cry of freedom and the primal ecstasy in the erotic moment proclaim as much, but so too does the symbol of the movement as a whole, the cobra about to strike. Yet this creatureliness is no simple recovery of a lost nature, for it also attests to the denaturing produced by World War, the Holocaust, and the bomb. Sometimes cobra creatures convey an irredeemable anguish. This is especially strong in Jorn, who stresses vulnerability in his figures, not, like Constant, voluptuousness. Wounded Beast 2 is another misshapen bird from the Cobra Menagerie, also painted full in the frame and pressed close to the picture plane. With a large head atop a little body, it appears in profile under a black sun, its whiskered beak haggard, its yellow eye crazed, its wings like limp flaps of dead flesh. This is not the only painting in which Jorn turns the eagle, the emblem of the state par excellence, into a terror-struck bird of prey. In this version, however, the world at large also appears wounded. The fracture of the painting seems to ravage everything within it. Here Jorn answers to the Constant call for a painting as an animal, a knight, a scream, a human being, or all of these. In fact, this definition, if anything so anti-formal can count as such, speaks to his cobra practice in general. Frequently, his version of the creaturely is all of these, a nocturnal animal hybrid and an anguished human being in one. This is our first clue as to what the creature is in Jorn. Once the word creature simply referred to the creation of God, here it resumes its modern meaning as a decreation produced by man. Like Caliban, the creature is not a natural animal, but a distorted human. A figure of freedom, perhaps, but an object of power more. One that emerges when limitations are dissolved. To borrow the Bataille language from last week, The creature might be an impossible hybrid of beast and sovereign. And this next section is titled Human Animal. Jorn often frames his work of this period in an expressionist way. It's an attempt to reclaim a primal unity before any psychic repression or social division. And in the Freudo-Marxist idiom of the time, he ascribes this fall to bourgeois class culture. Yet stylistically, his painting is not truly expressionist. Usually his gestures, both depicted and painterly, express little more than futility as gestures, as carriers of subjectivity. And his philosophy, which is also a patchwork, is anything but conventional. The bad object of this philosophy is monolithic, the classical tradition, by which Jorn means all European culture given over to Apollonian form. Here, of course, he follows the familiar critique presented by Nietzsche in The Birth of Tragedy of 1872. On the other hand, his good object is multiple. Sometimes Jorn calls it Dionysian rhythm, but he is just as likely to associate it with tribal art or folk culture, Taoist philosophy, or dialectical materialism. First and last, Jorn advocates any expression that advances materialist vitality over idealist fixity. Once more, he is affined with Dubuffet and Bataille here. In this regard, Jorn acts in the name of Scandinavian folk culture above all. In his view, the Nordic is the great other to the classical, at once marginal to it and subversive of it. In particular, he champions the pagan vernacular of the North, developed by the peasantry, or so he believed, in opposition to the official Christianity of the South, imported by the nobility. It is this commitment that drives not only his Cobra practice, both visual and textual, but also his project to reclaim the idea of the Nordic from its racist abuse by the Nazis. This project includes his plan, hugely ambitious plan, of 32 volumes devoted to 10,000 years of Nordic art, only six of which were completed and only one published in his lifetime, this one here. It also involves his founding of the Scandinavian Institute of Comparative Vandalism. The Vandal, especially the Viking, is his great anti-classical hero. It is this passionate anti-classicism, and again, he projects a myth of classicism to attack, it is this passionate anti-classicism that accounts for the extreme ugliness of his art, which Jorn pits with great delight against normative beauty, another point he has in common with Dubuffet and Bataille. Already in a 1947 text titled Apollo or Dionysius, Jorn proposes Dionysian rhythm as a counter to Apollonian form, but in such a way that the Apollonian is not so much animated by the Dionysian as undone by it. Again, this line of thought follows The Birth of Tragedy, where Nietzsche presents Apollo as the marvelous divine image of the principle of individuation, and Dionysus as its shattering. If individuation is the root of all evil for Nietzsche, so it is too for Jorn. This is strong not only in his philosophy, with his critique of all bourgeois distinctions in society and culture, and its advocacy of all collective forms of art, but also in his painting, where he often stages his own modernist deconstruction of the opposition between figure and ground, the principle of individuation in picture making. In fact, all his Cobra production is a concerted attack on classical aesthetics, which is also to say for Jorn, on classed aesthetics. Well before his situationist reworkings of flea market paintings known as modifications and disfigurations, he produced Cobra deformations of the classical tableau, if only here in postcard size. And he does so primarily through creaturely eruptions. We are for decomposition, Jorn wrote already in 1947, the destruction of classical composition. What classical composition means for Jorn seems to be simple enough. A well-composed tableau is a whole contained under a single point of view, Diderot wrote in his great essay on composition in his Encyclopédie, and Greuze was one of his exemplars. A single point of view in which the parts work together to one end and form by their mutual correspondence a unity as real as that of the members of the body of an animal, so that a piece of painting made up of a large number of figures thrown at random onto the canvas with neither proportion, intelligence, nor unity, no more deserves to be called a true composition than scattered studies of legs, nose, and eyes on the same cartoon deserve to be called a portrait or even a human figure. That's all Diderot. It is against this idealist model of the integrated painting, which significantly for us turns on the analogy of the body of an animal, that Jorn poses his materialist practice of disruptive creatures. The creaturely in Jorn is thus a matter of form as well as content, and it bears importantly on reception too. For he thought to disrupt the ideal composition of the tableau is also to disrupt the ideal composure of the viewer. Jorn has other targets in mind as well, such as the tableau as reinstated by a conservative socialist realism. Like some of his colleagues, he called his Cobra work painterly realism in defiance of this party line art. Now I want to underscore two points here. First, this decomposition is not due to any lack of skill, any more than the en forme figures in the caves were for Bataille. Schooled in composition under Leger, Jorn performs a de-skilling of the tableau, to which end he puts his painterly automatism, sometimes spiked with comic graffiti and scrawled text, a further violation of the integral picture. Like his Danish predecessors Egil Jacobsen and Richard Mortensen, Jorn releases color from drawing, and his palette favors the dim light of the Nordic over the bright clarity of the Mediterranean. There's a funny way in which Jorn could not get outside of very classical oppositions of North and South in his attack on the classical. In general, Jorn paints a subliminary world of nocturnal creatures, as in the moon and animals and the animals. Sometimes too, as in Wounded Beast too, he places his formless figures under a black sun. This is to advance another basic confusion here of day and night, and another detournement of the classical, here of its Apollonian heliotropism. Second, this critique is not as nihilistic as it appears. Jorn launches it largely from within the tableau, for only in this format can it be subversive, at least in his eyes. Thus, as much as Jorn challenges the tradition of the tableau, he is also invested in it. This is another affinity with Dubuffet. The future is made through relinquishing or sacrificing the past, Jorn writes in Detour and Painting of 1959. I want to rejuvenate European culture. I begin with art. Our past is full of becoming. One needs only to crack open the shells. So already at the moment of Cobra, his goal is détournement, not destruction. And yet this détournement is brutal, contesting as it does most of the classical criteria noted by Diderot: single point of view, pictorial integration, true composition, and so on. It also targets most of the academic genres of traditional painting. The creaturely disturbance of landscape is already announced in composition, color, and title in obtrusive creatures whose right to exist is proved by their existence, in which Jorn attempts to turn the idioms of Picasso and Miró toward his own disruptive ends, which they shared in part too. Yet a subversion is less static, more original, a decade later in Shameful Pastoral, where the ordering of space is undone by the hybrid creatures that swim, fly, and graze through it. Traditionally, the pastoral designates a scene in which common folk serve as foils for elevated subjects. But here we have only a commingling of mutants, most of which are painted in the pinkish white of human flesh, and all of which possess too many heads, legs, or wings. Together they enact the shameful pastoral of the title in a way that indicates a final corruption of this classical ideal of rural life. Jorn also undoes the exalted genre of history painting from within, most directly in his series of historical pictures. He mocks all nobility of action in titles like Nelson Orders the Bombardment of Copenhagen in 1807, and Foreign Ambassador Presents a Jet Fighter to the Nation as a Gift. And the depicted scenes derange the ideal figures of history painting as well. In Nelson Orders the Bombardment, faces are plunged into bodies, which are taught by toothy maws nonetheless. While the protagonists of Foreign Ambassador resemble so many bats and harpies. Although both paintings might call to mind a monstrous crucifixion by Hieronymus Bosch, reborn as an expressionist, Guernica is the proximate precedent. Yet the view of history in Jorn is even more brutal than in Picasso, precisely because it lacks any redemptive pathos. It is scabrous even in its humor. This nastiness is also strong in The Retreat at Tibol, 1864, a muddy mess in which the putative subject, the retreat of the Danish army during the Second War of Schleswig, is imagined as an animalistic regression. As in his other mock history paintings, Jorn treats a past episode as a scene not of edification, but of degradation, one that, as often with de Buffet, seems personal as well as national. As the mad gazes of these creatures suggest, this dark world is given over to an atavistic anxiety, a primal paranoia of predator and prey. The series of war visions from the same years is no less horrific. Like Wounded Beast 2, The Eagle's Share 1 transforms this emblem of state, which cuts across the opposed ideologies of the 20th century, into a multi-headed dragon, all eyes, talons, and teeth. There is a rage and a fear in this painting, Jorn remarked in retrospect, that I've never felt since. In 1957, Jorn began Stalingrad, No Man's Land, or The Mad Laughter of Courage, that's the full title, which he toiled over intermittently till 1972. At 3 by 5 meters, it is his largest painting. The title refers to the terrible battle of attrition waged by German and Soviet armies outside Stalingrad in 1943, a turning point in World War II. And the painting shows a scarred terrain of strokes and scrapes in which the bright yellow and blue scribbles only highlight the icy white and black expanse. Here the horrors of the 20th century have rendered history painting null and void, for Stalingrad is a world scored and scratched into illegibility, a painting in which representation, originally included imagery, is pushed beyond abstraction into destruction. We saw this convergence in de Buffet and Bataille too. And yet paradoxically, it is precisely in its illegibility that Stalingrad succeeds as a history painting, or so it could be claimed, for it captures the withering away of such experience. Recall Benjamin on this new poverty of experience. Who really knows how to tell a story? He asked. Here Jorn performs a negation of history painting, as well as a détournement of abstraction, the one through the other. On the one hand, history painting is both canceled and preserved. On the other, the language of abstract expressionism is compelled to evoke the very history that it refuses to depict. Given the importance of the human figure to the classical tableau, Jorn does his greatest damage in this genre. And again, it comes largely through the creaturely. Consider Interplanetary Woman. Here, a white mess topped by a misshapen head with yellow eyes looms like a comic ghost, subject to a gravity different from our own. The weird thing below her, painted in alien yellow, suggests a withered offspring. Jorn often includes such homunculi in his images, as if to mock any principle of individuation. Our gaze is sluiced around the picture along with the paint in a Dionysian rhythm that roils in the Apollonian form. And the effect is to make us feel a little woozy too. Even more creaturely is the figure in You'll Never Get Me Alive, a monster with a huge maw. Here, as elsewhere, Jorn pushes proper form toward an obscene formlessness. Obscene in the sense that this figure almost exceeds its frame, almost overrides the scene that stages it. This reading may be supported by the note that Jorn, along with D'Autremont, scrawled on the back of the painting. To our families and adorable fiancés, to priests, merchants, and all the other sharks, we have the pleasure of informing you in all modesty of our refusal to participate in the struggle for existence. At the time, the two friends were tuberculosis patients at the same sanatorium in Silkeborg, Denmark. It's not only the formlessness of such a creature that disturbs the academic genre of the figure. Also disruptive is the intensity of its gaze, not to mention the aggression of its mouth. This is almost programmatic in Yellow Eyes, a swirl of acrid colors punctuated by the shrill orbs of the title. But it is also present in other pictures of beasts with wild looks that render our aesthetic contemplation difficult. For Jacques Lacan, the fundamental aim of all painting is not to fool the eye, but to tame the gaze. It is not trompe l'oeil, but dompe regard. Again, to tame the gaze. He does not mean our individual vision, at least in the first instance, but rather the gaze of the world, that is, the very light around us that allows us to see in the first place. Lacan describes this light as awful, as pulsatile, dazzling, and spread out. And it is only by means of images, not only art, but all representation, that we can moderate this obscene radiance. Now, it is as though Jorn strives to undo, I think, this basic function of picturing as pacifying. It is as if his pictures were obscene in the sense that they tear at the art of painting understood as a protective screen or as a sublimatory scene. This is another primordial convention, maybe the primordial convention of art, to tame the gaze, challenged by one of our artists, and not by Jorn alone. Recall the Medusian Minerva of Du Buffet. This effect of painting thrown open via the creaturely to the untamed gaze of the world is intimated by Jorn in pictures like Faces in a Head, where the exalted head, the paragon of form in traditional art, the seat of pure vision and lofty intellection, becomes an inchoate ground where form is undone. Now, this, of course, is an impossible project to somehow undo this basic function of painting, this basic function of art. But it's one that I believe Jorn wants to take up. The problem is that it often leads him to very kitschy paintings. And in ways that I can't explain today, that didn't bother him. He was happy to take on kitsch, in part because he saw kitsch as an expression of a commonality of the people that he wanted to tap as well. Finally, the creaturely in Jorn often calls up the foul, another defiling not only of beauty, but also of order. He gives generic names like brute and troll to some of his beasts, and invents mythical terms such as Falbo and Agonach for others. In the eponymous series, Agonach shapeshifts as pig, tortoise, alligator, beetle, and so on. This creature suggests a lowly being of pollution, once subject to ritual prohibition. Holiness requires that individuals shall conform to the class to which they belong, Mary Douglas writes in Purity and Danger of 1966, her classic text on the operations of taboo. And holiness requires that different classes of things shall not be confused. Such confusion abounds in Jorn, who seems to take Leviticus, the Old Testament book that lays down the law about unclean food, as a script for his taboo-defying creature-making. Taboos focus on creatures that frustrate classification, Douglas tells us. And her examples are pertinent here. Eels and worms inhabit water, though not as fish. Reptiles go on dry land, though not as quadrupeds. Some insects fly, though not as birds. There is no order in them. Recall what the prophecy of Habakkuk says of them. For thou makest men like the fish of the sea, like crawling things that have no ruler, no law. Why create such lawless beings? Habakkuk demands of God. And in a way, Jorn carries this rebuke further with his mutants, which are almost the opposite of totems. Totems are animal avatars used by a social group to separate, to speciate its members. These creatures affect the opposite. For example, the moon and the animals in this painting, the bird on the left is semi-reptilian with scales on its head, while the animal on the right is semi-human, bipedal, as it appears to be. And in Shameful Pastoral, humans seem to combine with animals and both with fish and plant life in a violation of the most fundamental distinctions of all. Here the Diderotian paradigm of the tableau as perfect body is most defiled, most defied. The next part is called positive negation. What moves Jorn to produce such creatures? Already toward the end of the war, his paintings are dominated by creaturely masks, which he associates generally with tribal art. In order to express psychic experiences in dramatic form, Jorn writes at the time, these artists bring before the face a mask, which is wholly different from a face. A totally new creature comes into being, neither animal nor human. At this point, Jorn still refers such representations to human psychic needs. In other words, he sees them in existential, even ontological terms. However, he also suggests that his motives are particular. The folk tales and myths speak of monsters, fantastic animals, and signs, Jorn tells us, tells Constant in his 1950 letter. Yet they are always symbols of people, of real phenomena, too. Certainly the Cobra period was a time of great personal strain for Jorn. In extreme poverty, he developed tuberculosis, which kept him in the sanatorium from spring 1951 to fall 1952. It was also a period of great historical tension. As evoked in the Pact of Predators, Jorn viewed the NATO agreement of April 1949 as a locking in of the treacherous antagonism of the Cold War. He produced several works on the theme of entangled enemies during this period, including this very dark one. And the outbreak of the Korean War in June 1950 pointed to yet another world conflagration, which threatened to be final because nuclear. Jorn evokes both registers of crisis, personal and public, through his creatures, which often appear sickly or mutant. Sometimes, too, they are foul in the sense given by Douglas. On these matters, his central text is The Human Animal of 1950-51, which Jorn was prompted to write by critics who had compared him to Kafka. In fact, Jorn had translated several Kafka stories into Danish a decade before. Here, Jorn rejects the dominant account of Kafka as an existentialist. In his view, such a reading depoliticizes the writings. Rather than cliches of angst, Jorn saw characters such as Gregor Samsa in relation to ancient traditions of the human animal. Jorn notes that many cultures in America and Europe, as well as in Egypt, India, and Persia, represented gods as half human and half animal. However, this is his argument, in the Western Middle Ages, these same figures were transformed into devilish representations of evil alone. What motivated this reversal, he asks? Why does the dragon continue to be the holy sign of China and the Orient? He asks, perhaps also with the cobra in mind, while the dragon killer has become the most popular symbol of the West, the symbol of the struggle against evil. This is a Bataillean question, and like Bataille, Jorn is interested in the transitive nature of value. The truth of the human animal, he insists, is a continuous movement from state to state, from good to evil, and back again. And though it is occluded in modern culture, this truth, Jorn thought, is glimpsed by Kafka, who transforms some of his characters into an animal state in order to reveal it. For Jorn, what plagues Kafka creatures is a failure to love altruistically, a failure to bond socially. And in fact, the stories that he chose to translate all concern a missed encounter between people. Certainly, this creaturely metamorphosis is a form of punishment, as it is in many folk tales. Jorn refers to Pinocchio in particular. But it is also a matter, he says, of pleasure, even redemption, because it involves a release not only from the fear of the bestial, but also from the curse of the good. Recall that Bataille sees a similar release in the therianthropic figures in the cave, such as the sorcerer of the Trois Frères. This figure also fascinated Jorn, who included it in his study of mixed beings in myth and legend, the golden horns and the wheel of fortune. You see him verted or turned, the upper left there. Jorn terms such creaturely transformation a positive negation of the human, one that discloses the dynamic relativity of good and evil. It is a negation that Jorn performs, or wishes to perform, in his work too. It is not only his primary response to the cobra call to tap the vital source of life and to touch the origin of creative activity, but also his distinctive version of the materialist equivocality that we saw in Dubuffet and Bataille, and we'll see again in Palozzi and Oldenburg. However, Jorn answers this call in a manner that makes clear that this vital source is both remote from us and distorted by us. Let me elaborate on this positive negation of the human through two juxtapositions. First, I will set Jorn alongside Bataille on the human animal in the same years, with an eye to a particular aspect of Bataillean thought I discussed a little bit last time. Then I will consider Jorn in light of recent reflections on the creaturely as a symptom of a crisis in a symbolic order, reflections that are indebted to Bataille and anticipated by Jorn. Once again, the two concerns converge on the enigmatic question of origins. Here are the origins of sovereignty and law. Although Jorn did not cite Bataille, he did know some of the writings, and they share several concerns. A rejection of classical humanism, in part through an exploration of the en-forme, the formless. A critique of all idealisms, which included for Bataille the elevated idea of surrealism advanced by Breton, and for Jorn the academic painting of surrealism associated with Magritte. And a notion of art as expenditure. If Bataille theorized excess, Jorn practiced it. His output of paintings and writings was enormous. Most salient here, however, is a shared fascination with the human animal. Again, this interest was reignited for Bataille in the early 1950s by the publication of 400 centuries of cave art by the Abbé Henri Breuil. In the prehistoric images in southern France and northern Spain, Bataille argues, we see not only the birth of art, but also the passage from animal to man. Yet this decisive step is a paradoxical one, for sometimes humanity is not clearly distinguished from animality in the caves. Or more precisely, sometimes early man disguised his humanity at the very moment he claimed it. Recall the stick figure in Lascaux with the face of a bird, or the horned men at Les Trois Frères with the heads and hooves of bisons and stags. What seems to be fundamental is the rejection of our face, Bataille notes. Paleolithic man masked the face of which we are so proud, and he flaunted that which our clothes conceal, that is, his sex. The very instant that man prevailed over the animal, he apologized for the domination and blurred the difference. Thus, according to Bataille, was the status of the animal fraught for early man. Positioned not only below the human, but also above it, the animal was seen as more holy, which is to say more sacred, more divine. It's Bataille still. Nothing is more common in prehistoric art, and Jorn would add, in non-classical art, than the representation of a god in the form of an animal. For early man, the animal had a divine quality that the human form could not have expressed. This enigmatic connection between animal and god is a leitmotif in Bataille, who is fascinated by the shared alterity, shared otherness of both beast and sovereign to man. And Jorn was too. At times, both frame this alterity, this heterogeneity, in ontological terms. Recall that for Jorn, the equivocal truth of man resides in a continuous movement from state to state. However, this ontological orientation was pressured by historical events. Just as Bataille first focused on sovereignty during the period of fascism and Nazism, so Jorn foregrounded the creaturely soon after the catastrophes of the World War and the Holocaust, and in the midst of the everyday terror of the Cold War, which is also to say during the continued failure of European humanism to address such disasters. It was this predicament that led Jorn, like Bataille, to seek a new, true foundation for artistic culture and human society alike. This leads us to the creaturely in recent discourse. Over the last two decades, the Bataillean question of the connection between animal and God, beast and king, has returned in critical theory. As developed by Jacques Derrida and Giorgio Agamben, this inquiry is concerned with the foundation of law and the nature of sovereignty, both of which mark the passage from animal to man. More precisely, it is concerned with the lack of any solid basis for these institutions, at least any basis that is not produced in violence, the sheer violence of self-authorized power. It is this paradox that intrigues these philosophers, that the beginnings of law and sovereignty might lie in an exception to the just rule that they otherwise purport to represent and to secure. Before his death in 2004, Derrida devoted his last seminars to the beast and the sovereign. What interests Derrida is that even though the two are opposites, the one lowly, the other supreme, the one beneath the law, the other above it, they share an exteriority to human society, which has often led the one to be represented in the guise of the other, the prince as wolf, the lion as king, and so on. The celebrated instance of this unexpected convergence is the representation of the ruler as Leviathan in the eponymous tract by Hobbes of 1651. I've shown you this frontispiece before. The Bataille would point to cave paintings and Jorn to Scandinavian carvings. His volume on 12th century stone sculpture in southern Sweden includes a representation of one king gnawed by two lions and another bitten by two snakes, which we might take to image this belonging together in opposition of sovereign and beast. In any case, it is this mutual attraction of the two that Derrida searches for a key to the greater mystery of the foundation of law, or again, the absence of any such basis outside of violence. Here Derrida is close to Agamben, who elaborated on sovereign power and bare life in his influential Homo Sacer of 1995. Bare life, Agamben writes in a well-known definition, is the life of Homo Sacer, sacred man, who may be killed and yet not sacrificed. This man is sacred only in the antithetical sense of the word long lost to us. That is, he is sacred because he is accursed at the mercy of all. In Roman society, Homo Sacer was the lowest of the low. Yet as such, he was also the complement of the highest of the high. At the two extreme limits of the order, Agamben writes, the sovereign and Homo Sacer present two symmetrical figures that have the same structure and are correlative. The sovereign is the one with respect to whom all men are potentially homines sacri, and Homo Sacer is the one with respect to whom all men act as sovereigns. Essentially, with the doubling of sovereign and beast is in Derrida, the doubling of sovereign and Homo Sacer is in Agamben, a riddle that points to how power is founded in a primordial yoking of violence and law. And it is this knot, the ruler as the point of indistinction between violence and law, the threshold on which violence passes over into law and law passes over into violence, that both thinkers attempt to tease out. This is not a new riddle. It is central to Western political thought from Aristotle and man as the political animal through Hobbes and Rousseau on the passage from the state of nature to the commonwealth and the social contract, respectively, to Benjamin on the inextricability of violence and law, Bataille on the heterogeneous status of the sovereign, and above all, Carl Schmitt on the exception to the law that founds the law. In Schmidt, this exception is not a primordial act lost in the mists of time. It recurs whenever a government declares a state of emergency and suspends its own judicial codes. This is largely why we have seen a Schmittian turn in political theory and cultural criticism in recent years. For once again, we live in a time when emergency is more norm than exception. Where is the creaturely in this discourse? As another theorist, Eric Sandor, sees it, the eruption of the creaturely in art or literature signals a decreation in the human order, a crisis in which life appears abandoned to the state of emergency. This is close to Agamben on Bare Life, yet almost alone in this discourse, Sandor thinks this condition from the position of homo sacer, from the place of the beast, as it were, on the threshold where life takes on its specific biopolitical intensity, where it assumes, this is Sandor now, the cringe posture of the creature. In his own way, Jorn images such a condition for us, I think. For Sandor, this cringe is produced by exposure to a traumatic dimension of political power. When life becomes a direct matter of politics, and politics penetrates the very matter of life. Such penetration is obscene, to be sure, but in its very deformation of the subject, it can be revelatory as well. For power is also revealed in this exposure, and potentially it is revealed as not only constructed, but also groundless, or at least is not grounded in justice and thus subject to our challenge. Unlike the beast, then, the creaturely is not the double of the sovereign so much as the object witness of its violence. There is a political knowledge to be gained here, and paradoxically, perhaps, a revolutionary delight, too. Benjamin speaks ambiguously of the ecstasy of the creature. What I am calling creaturely life, Sandor writes, is the life that is, so to speak, called into being, excited by exposure to the peculiar creativity associated with this threshold between law and non-law. Might this excitement be related to the pleasure that the creatures in Kafka enjoy, along with the punishment they endure? Certainly, Jorn summons this contradictory affect in creatures such as Falbo, a painting subtitled The Cry of the Beast. Again, the creaturely cringe is not only undead, but also excited. And in one painting, Jorn calls a similar gesture both timid and proud. This creature might be taken to cower, or to challenge, or like the sorcerer of Les Trois Frères, to do both impossibly at once. The creativity at the threshold between law and non-law can also take the form of critique, for the fault lines in a political system are revealed there. Fissures in the space of meaning, gaps in the symbolic order, which might be turned into points of purchase, where power can be resisted or at least rethought, where new social links might be imagined or old displaced ones recovered. Certainly this was the case for the aforementioned philosophers who witnessed the workings of power during times of crisis. Hobbes wrote Leviathan during the English Civil War. Again, his book appeared in 1651. Rousseau conceived the social contract as the authority of European kings and princes began to be questioned. His text was published in 1762. Benjamin published his Critique of Violence in 1921 in the wake of the destroyed German Empire and in the midst of Freikorps rampages. And again, Bataille debated the nature of sovereignty as fascism and Nazism spread through Europe. It is also no accident that Derrida, Agamben, and Sandor reflected on this subject during the George W. Bush regime, which produced flawed presidential elections, the deception of the Iraq War, and the debacle of the occupation, Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo Bay, rendition to torture camps, and all the rest. An intermittent state of emergency that Obama used discreetly and Trump indulges in wantonly. During this extended time, for all the discussion of failed states elsewhere, our own government has come to operate routinely and destructively as a rogue. The rogue, Derrida reminds us, is one that does not even respect the law of the animal community, of the pack, the horde of its kind. And in this capacity, it threatens us all, however unequally. Okay, my last section, I promise it is brief, is called Peculiar Creativity. The historical conditions for the recent discourse on the beast and the sovereign are clear enough. But what are its implications for our understanding of Jorn? If the creatures in Kafka are pre-war examples of the peculiar creativity associated with this threshold between law and non-law, the creatures in Jorn stand as post-war instances. As announced in the emblem of the snake, this excited animality is active in Cobra at large, where again its force is ambiguous, a portent of new freedom, a sign of total collapse, or somehow both at once. Recall Constant in his Cobra Manifesto, Desires Build the Revolution of 1949. On the one hand, we need to break the bonds which have kept us within the social system. On the other, such limitations are already dissolved. Or consider Jorn in his Cobra text, Luck and Chance, of 1952, where he underscores the ceaseless dialectic, not only between ethics and aesthetics, but also between the establishment of law and law-breaking. Sometimes Jorn aligns with Bataille, and indeed Benjamin, on these matters. Law creates law-breaking, he writes, law-breaking creates law. At other times, he seems to channel Schmitt. It is the exception that proves the law of rule by renewing it. In any case, his understanding of the ceaseless dialectic of law breaking and remaking allows Jorn, like Bataille, to escape the double bind of transgression that sometimes trapped de Buffet. Of course, one might argue that the violations of painting in Jorn, as in de Buffet, serve only to reinscribe its particular laws. And yet, for the most part, Jorn effects a detournement of this art, which he gives a Nietzschean inflection here. Détournement is a game born of the capacity for devalorization. Only he who is able to devalorize can create new values. And then he adds this revolutionary twist, which I have quoted already. I want to rejuvenate European culture. I begin with art. Our past is full of becoming. One needs only to crack open the shells. In this last line, he buries a reference to Marx on Hegel. The dialectic in Hegel is idealist, literally upside down, Marx argued in his afterword to Capital. It must be inverted, grounded in materialism, in order to discover the rational kernel within the mystical shell. For Jorn, a similar cracking open had to be performed in painting, steeped as it was in idealist discourses. Already in form conceived as language, a text of 1949, he declared that a materialist art must put art back on the foundation of the senses in a way common to the senses of all men. This last phrase is a direct quote from Marx. In effect, Jorn sought to overthrow one order of art so that another might be installed. Painting is over, he proclaims. You might as well finish it off. Détourne, long live painting. This is not quite the king is dead, long live the king, but it is close. Jorn wanted to maintain the authority of this art, indeed to rejuvenate the sovereignty of European culture, but only if it were redirected radically. Only through sacrificing the past could it live again. What exactly did this program entail for Jorn? In some ways, he carried over the ceaseless dialectic of law and law-breaking into his own life. Restless with the social strictures of home and work, he was both a maker and a destroyer of bonds, familial and artistic. He married or partnered several times and founded or joined multiple groups. In his practice, too, there was a continual movement between collaborative creation and individual vandalization, such as his modifications and disfigurations, like this one. Involvement in collective work is a through line in Jorn, from his contributions to the Helhesten group, his collaboration with Cobra colleagues on texts and murals. Through his proposal of an Imaginist Bauhaus in 1953, in part to protest against the functionalist new Bauhaus under Max Bill, which included painterly and ceramic experiments in Italy and Denmark. In his founding of the Situationist International with Constant and De Boer in 1957, which involved more publications, mostly with De Boer, to his launching of the Scandinavian Institute of Comparative Vandalism and its ambitious scheme of books in the mid-1960s. For Jorn, the production of useful objects was generative of social harmony, and they felt that the Nordic way was to view art as a spiritual, intellectual accompaniment to life rather than an institution apart from it. So too, he saw his collaborative projects as experimental models of a communal order to come, for which he sought resources in media, old and new. Already before the war, Jorn insisted on the artistic value of banality and the symbolic strength of clichés. Both offered a connection with the fundamental and with the whole, the people. In effect, he intimated a barbarianhood of the banal. Recall that Benjamin used the word barbarentum for his positive barbarism, with the banal here understood as a culture that is common in the sense of put down or cast out. That is what the ban in banal means, that which is banned or abandoned. Before the war, Benjamin could still hope for a proletarian culture to come. After the war, this was far more difficult, and this barbarianhood of the banal is a stopgap, with the proletarian subject of history largely thwarted and no new one clearly on the rise. Jorn did support anti-colonial and anti-war movements, but he was not much moved by feminism. Here, however, I want to appeal one last time to the creaturely in his art as a sign of cracks in the symbolic order opened up by an exposure to the traumatic dimension of political power. Neither an outside, as in the Dubuffet proposal of Art Brut, nor an origin, as in the Bataille exploration of the caves, the creaturely in Jorn points to fissures, to cracks on the inside of law and order here and now. Lines that art might help to reveal, and which might be turned into points of purchase, where again, power can be resisted and rethought, where new social links might be imagined, where old social ones recovered. Now, I will return to this difficult question of law and violence and the figures of sovereignty and its loss next time with Eduardo Polozzi. But maybe that's enough, maybe that's too much for today. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art production.